This morning, Eugene will be back in the pulpit and returning to his series on 1 Samuel, picking up at the beginning of chapter 4. For a scripture reading, he's chosen a very familiar verse from Revelation 3, verse 20. "Here I am. I stand at the door and knock. If anyone hears my voice and opens the door, I will come in and eat with that person, and they with me." Eugene, come on up.
Good morning. So I am Eugene. I'm one of the preaching pastors here at PBCC. You guys who were here last week may have remembered that my wife, Pastor Heading, was finishing up her series on the letter of James, or at least this batch of sermons on it. I would have loved to hear more from Heading and the letter of James, but it was her birthday yesterday, and I thought it wouldn't be very fair to spring that on her to this morning. I'm also very excited to return to the first book of Samuel. The mini-series we are beginning today is called The Lord, Powerful, Present Person. Its focus will be on knowing God as the powerful, present, and personal being He is. If you've been attending PBCC for a while, this might sound familiar. On the landing page of our website, you'll see a phrase that has become something like our church motto: knowing Jesus and making Him known. This is our commitment as a community of Jesus followers. But what do we mean by this phrase, knowing Jesus? What does it mean to know Jesus? Well, the first thing that comes to many of our minds is probably something educational. Knowing Jesus is about learning what He taught and what He valued, what He did, and the ways He did it. And it's natural for us to think this way. After all, God has revealed Himself primarily through literary texts gathered together into a rather large book. It's natural to connect knowing God to learning the contents of that book. But is that all there is to knowing God? Does the Bible itself define knowing God in this way? Well, any student of the Bible can tell you that no, the biblical authors did not define knowing God in merely educational terms. The Hebrew and Greek words in the original texts of the Bible, which we translate as know and knowing, carry a richer, deeper meaning that includes intellectual knowledge, but often goes far beyond it. The Bible speaks of knowing God the way a lover knows their beloved, with all the intimacy that implies. So, when we commit ourselves to knowing Jesus and making Him known, what we mean is that we don't want to settle for knowledge about God. We want a genuine relationship with God. We want to know God not as an object, but as a person, whom we address not primarily in the third person as an it, but in the second person as a you. In His bizarre, inscrutable, beautiful and profound text, I and Thou, the 20th century Jewish philosopher Martin Buber meditated on this idea of relating in the third and second person. It would be impossible to explain everything he said in that book, but let me summarize what is useful for us today. Each of us has a sense of ourselves as distinct from other things or people in this world. We have an I, a sense of agency, of autonomy, of personhood. But for those other things or people in this world, we have a choice. We can relate to each as an object, as an it, or as a person, as a you. An object, an it, doesn't have to be tangible, but it can be studied. It can be measured, dissected, compared, contrasted, and so on. We can distance ourselves from it, taking the role of observer, of analyst, of student with respect to it. And having studied it, we can make judgments about it, declare what is good or bad about it. But a person cannot be so reduced. A person with whom we are fully, genuinely, presently engaged cannot be reduced to an it. A person so engaged can only rightly be called a you. a you standing before us, staring at us, speaking to us, and receiving from us our own gaze and our own words. A you sharing themselves with us in a moment of connection demands our full attention and keeps us from distancing ourselves and turning them into something to study, an object or an it. In that moment of connection, the you present before us becomes everything, and we bring ourselves fully into that moment, knowing ourselves seen and heard and not objectified either, not reduced to the other person's it. When that moment is over, well, we might look back on the encounter from the distance of time elapsed, and then we can reflect. Then we can study, we can dissect, we can analyze the moment, and perhaps even the person has now become an object or an it to us. But in the moment of encounter, there's no possibility of objectification. There's only the I and the you bound in relationship. Now, that's a lot of words, but here's a simple, practical way to enter into what Buber was talking about. After service today, try thinking of someone you care about, like a spouse, a significant other, a close friend, and try telling them this. You know, I've known you for a long time now. When we first met, I had a lot of questions about you. But over the years, I've gotten most of them answered. I've studied and analyzed you. I know enough about you now, so we don't have to talk anymore. With the data I've scraped from your life, I've developed a predictive model of your consciousness that I'll be using from now on in place of hanging out with you so we can cancel lunch next Tuesday. Brothers and sisters, hopefully you know I'm being facetious here. Please don't actually do this to anyone. Even if it was possible to know everything about a person, that accumulation of facts could never replace a relationship with that person. And it would be foolish to try. It would even be painful to try. Some of us know this foolishness firsthand, either from reducing or being reduced by another person to an object of study, an it. Such reduction is painful and soul-crushing. But on the other hand, relating to a person as a you makes us feel truly alive. Buber goes so far as to say we are not truly persons until we engage one another in the I and you relationship. I require a you to become, he wrote. Becoming I say you, in all actual life is encounter. Now, what does all this have to do with God in 1 Samuel? Everything. Over the next few Sundays, we'll be looking at a story told across 1 Samuel chapters 4 through 6. At first glance, this story seems to be about ancient Israel and her great rival Philistia. But on closer examination, it becomes clear that this story is really about the relationship between God and his people. The question of how the people of Israel will relate to God reverberates over the chapters we'll be reading, and I hope the question reverberates in our hearts as well. How do we relate to God? Is he an object or a person? Is he an it or a you? What does the way we live and act and make our decisions reveal about who or what God is to us? By God's grace, we will grow into answers appropriate to the powerful, present person of who he is. And so to that end, let us pray together. Dear God, you are God. You are. You. Let us know you. In Jesus' name. Amen. Now, one more word before we get into the word. With stories like the one we'll be looking at, we are often tempted to see ourselves as Israel in the story. And that often leads to seeing our enemies as the Philistines, or the Egyptians, or Assyrians, Babylonians, Romans, etc. It's tempting to see our enemies as whoever is the enemy in the text, in the story. But the proclamation of the gospel is that Jesus Christ has destroyed the dividing wall of hostility, Ephesians 2:14, creating friends out of former enemies. The reconciling work of Jesus Christ has restored us to relationship with God, but also to our fellow human beings and even to nature itself. No one who has pledged their allegiance to Jesus can say, therefore, that they have enemies. To do so would imply that Christ's work wasn't enough. There may be people who treat us like enemies for whatever reason, but Christ has liberated us from the need to respond in kind, from the cycle of vengeance. Those who see others as enemies, simply put, deny the gospel of Jesus Christ, who said of his own enemies, of his own so-called enemies, of those crucifying him, Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they are doing. So, just as a word of notice, I will not be allegorizing the conflict between the Israelites and the Philistines to justify my or anyone else's hatred of another. I simply won't do it. And as I hope you'll see, the story itself resists being applied in such a way. Well, with that said, let's actually get into our text for today. By the end of 1 Samuel chapter 3, the boy Samuel had grown up and taken his place as prophet of the Lord. The Lord was with Samuel as he grew up, and he let none of Samuel's words fall to the ground. And all Israel, from Dan to Beersheba, recognized that Samuel was attested as a prophet of the Lord. The Lord continued to appear at Shiloh, and there he revealed himself to Samuel through his word. Now, each of these three verses confirms the same fact. Samuel was a prophet, a spokesperson for God. The story we'll be looking at this month begins with a fourth affirmation of Samuel's role. And Samuel's word came to all Israel. Samuel's word was not his word alone, but whatever message God had given him to deliver to his people. And not just to some Israelites, but to all Israel. Samuel ministered to all God's people, and all God's people knew of Samuel's prophetic ministry. This is an important point to which we will return later. But for now, we go to battle. Now the Israelites went out to fight against the Philistines. The Israelites camped at Ebenezer, and the Philistines at Aphek. The Philistines were a rival people group in the ancient Near East whose territorial aggression and monopoly over iron production made them a significant threat to the people of Israel. Pastor and Bible scholar Eugene Peterson explains the cursed Philistines had been Israel's local enemy par excellence for 200 years and would continue as an irritant for another 300. Bracketed by the earlier Egyptian oppression and the later Babylonian exile, the Philistines take their place among the big three enemies in Israel's history. Geographically, however, Philistia was relatively small. The map on the left shows the 12 tribes of Israel in the 11th century BC, or thereabouts. Philistia is there on the bottom left, sandwiched between the Mediterranean Sea and the tribe of Judah. The map on the right zooms in on the five city-states that made up Philistia: Gaza, Ashkelon, Ashdod, Gath, and Ekron. As you can see, that Ekron was situated in land claimed by the Israelite tribe of Dan, and you can imagine how that went. With such overlapping territorial claims, conflicts could erupt deep in the seemingly settled territory of Israel. The red-crossed swords and northwest Ephraim mark where the battle in our passage took place between Ebenezer and Aphek. Now this battle did not go well for Israel. The Philistines deployed their forces to meet Israel. And as the battle spread, Israel was defeated by the Philistines, who killed about 4,000 of them on the battlefield. The Israelites were forced to retreat, regroup, and reflect on what had gone wrong. When the soldiers returned to camp, the elders of Israel asked, "Why did the Lord bring defeat on us today before the Philistines?" Commentator David Zamora describes the elders of Israel as a group of senior tribal leaders who were entrusted with important decisions. They were representatives of the congregation.
These representative elders voiced the question on everyone's mind: why did the Lord bring defeat on us today before the Philistines? The elders of Israel recognized that in his sovereignty over the events of history, God had allowed their defeat to happen. The question was, why? Let's sit with the elders for a moment. What feelings might have stood behind their question? What might they have been feeling as they saw their countrymen coming back from the battle, bloodied and bruised? The author of Samuel didn't spell it out, but it's not hard to imagine the sorrow, the grief, even the disappointment the soldiers and elders must have felt that day. It's not hard to imagine the terror of the battlefield taking its toll and putting them all in a posture of fear and maybe even anger. And it's not hard to imagine fear and anger making it difficult for the elders to make a wise decision on what to do next. Immediately after expressing their distress, in literally the next sentence, the elders of Israel announced a decision. Let us bring the Ark of the Lord's covenant from Shiloh so that he may go with us and save us from the hand of our enemies. The elders assumed that God's presence had not been sufficiently with the Israelite army that day. So they needed to do something to guarantee that God go out with them and fight alongside them against their enemies. And what better way to do this than to bring, literally to take, the Ark of the Lord's covenant and deploy it on the battlefield? Now, by way of reminder, the Ark of the Lord's Covenant was a wooden box inlaid with gold, made to represent God's presence among his people. It contained several objects of great spiritual and historic significance: an original set of tablets engraved with the Ten Commandments, the staff of Aaron that had budded to confirm his priesthood, and a jar of manna from Israel's wilderness wanderings. Now, atop the box was a lid called the mercy seat, adorned with two golden cherubim bowing towards the space between them. And God manifested his presence between the cherubim atop the mercy seat, turning the ark into a throne. Thus, as Samura summarizes, the ark was the visible sign of the holy presence of Yahweh, whose real throne is on high above the heavens. Now, the ark had rings at each of its corners through which poles could be slid. Using these poles, the ark could be moved from one place to another, say, if the house of the Lord had to be relocated. Or, say, if the Israelite army wanted to use the ark, or the God whose presence rested on it, as a weapon of mass destruction. In the wake of their defeat, the elders of Israel decided that the best way to ensure that God was on their side was to grab him by the poles and to take his throne into battle. So the people sent men to Shiloh, and they brought back the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord Almighty, who is enthroned between the cherubim. Yes, the author of Samuel just full named the Ark of the Covenant. The Ark of the Covenant of the Lord Almighty, who is, in case you forgot, enthroned between the cherubim. The author of Samuel wanted us to be very clear on what exactly the Israelites were taking and bringing and using for their purposes. The picture gets worse. And Eli's two sons, Hophni and Phinehas, were there with the Ark of the Covenant of God. Now, it's never good when Hophni and Phinehas show up in the narrative. Now, of course, they were real people. And I'm sure they had their own wounds that played a part in making them who they were. If they happened to show up to our church one Sunday and ask to talk with someone about their sin, I'd want to sit with them. I'd want to hear their confession. I'd want to share with them the gospel of Jesus Christ. I'd want to walk with them through repentance, because that's what others literally have done with me. Actually, in this room. But they weren't repentant. And when people unrepentantly guilty of sexual assault and of profiting off their positions of power used religious symbolism to rally those on their side against their enemies, brothers and sisters, that is a bad sign. We should see their appearance as red flags and expect something bad to happen. The Israelite army, however, didn't expect anything but a victorious counterattack. They rallied around Hophni, Phinehas, and the Ark. When the Ark of the Lord's covenant came into the camp, all Israel raised such a great shout that the ground shook. The Israelites' surging confidence at this moment made what happened next all the more tragic. In a brilliant directorial move, the author of Samuel swung their attention to the Philistine army. Hearing the uproar, the Philistines asked, "What's all this shouting in the Hebrew camp?" Like the elders of Israel a few verses earlier, the Philistines were confused. What was giving these Israelites so much confidence? When they learned that the Ark of the Lord had come into the camp, the Philistines were afraid. "A God has come into the camp," they said. "Oh no, nothing like this has happened before." The Philistines interpreted the arrival of the Ark the same way the Israelites did. "A God has come into the camp." But the Philistines were in the wrong camp, on the wrong side. And so the Philistines lifted up a cry, "We're doomed. Who will deliver us from the hand of these mighty gods?" They are the gods who struck the Egyptians with all kinds of plagues in the wilderness. Now the Philistines demonstrated an unexpected familiarity with the history of the God of Israel. Sure, they got some things wrong. God is singular, not plural. The plagues were not deployed in the wilderness, but in Egypt itself. But the Philistines had the right idea. Yes, this was the God who defeated mighty Egypt with an incredible display of irresistible power. What might such a powerful God do against Philistia? Theologian Walter Brueggemann observes, "The Philistines are presented as superb interpreters of the history and faith of Israel." But as Heading reminded us some weeks ago from the letter of James, knowing about God does not in itself produce a right attitude towards God. Even the demons believe that God is one and shudder. James 2:19. The Philistines feared the Lord, but not in a way that brought them to surrender. Instead, their fear became a rallying cry. "Be strong, Philistines! Be men, or you will be subject to the Hebrews, as they have been to you. Be men and fight." And this is where an audience conditioned by Hollywood would expect an eye-watering, ear-ringing, seat-shaking, CGI-infused spectacle to unfold across the battlefield. Music swelling, swords clashing, spears spearing, slingshots slinging, and then desperately but courageously, Hophni and Phinehas readying the cherubim on the Ark of the Covenant, which are actually, surprise, nuclear laser cannons. And then at last, a thundering silence declaring victory for the Israelites. What we actually see in the text is rather anticlimactic and deeply tragic. So the Philistines fought, and the Israelites were defeated, and every man fled to his tent. The slaughter was very great. Israel lost 30,000 foot soldiers. Samura explains the idiom, "To flee to his own tent is not simply to retreat, but to abandon military service altogether." The defeat was so devastating, it discouraged the Israelites from ever wanting to fight again. Indeed, it's hard to comprehend just how extreme this defeat was. In their previous defeat, the Israelites lost 4,000 soldiers, which is already hard to comprehend. This time, they lost more than 7 times as many people. And it turns out they lost even more than that. The Ark of God was captured, and Eli's 2 sons, Hophni and Phinehas, died. The Ark of the Covenant of the Lord Almighty, who is enthroned between the cherubim, was captured, literally taken. The same word used when Hophni and Phinehas brought the Ark to the battlefield. It's as if the Israelites had already lost the ark the moment they decided to use it as a tool, as a weapon against their enemies. Speaking of Hophni and Phinehas, they died when the ark was taken by the Philistines. Their simultaneous deaths fulfilled the prophecy delivered to their father Eli by the unnamed prophet in chapter 2. And what happens to your two sons, Hophni and Phinehas, will be assigned to you. They will both die on the same day. But no one expected that their deaths would occur as a footnote to the loss of the Ark of the Covenant, the symbol of God's presence among and relationship with his people. As we did earlier, let's take a moment to sit with the Israelites. What might they have felt in the wake of this terrible loss? What might they have felt seeing the Ark of the Covenant taken and leaders of God's house dead? How devastating this defeat must have been for Israel. How disturbing. How disorienting. Brueggemann observes this defeat can be understood only as the will of Yahweh. That recognition creates a much more urgent theological crisis in Israel. And perhaps it was just such a theological crisis the elders of Israel were trying to avoid in the first place. A crisis captured by the question, why did the Lord bring defeat on us today before the Philistines? Underneath this question is a deeper question, a harder question, a question no one enjoys asking, not even me. Why does God do things I don't want him to do? At the risk of disappointing you all, let me say right now that I don't know. I don't know why God does what he does. I've asked him. I've gotten answers before, but those answers always seem to have expiration dates. I don't know why God allowed Israel to be defeated that first time. We're not told. And I'm not entirely sure I know why he did the second time either. I have my thoughts. You all pay me, in a sense, to think. And I try my best to wrap up my thoughts and prayers and reflections into a sermon about God. I try my best to study him, to analyze him, and even sometimes to critique him. And I often find myself coming up against something, as I did while preparing for this sermon series. And that is that God is not an it to be studied. He's not even a he, in the sense that he becomes it really easily in my attitude towards him. God is not a theorem to be explained. He's not an algorithm that gives us predictable results. God is not a system to be understood the way we understand internal combustion engines or a recipe for banana bread. God is a person. God is a you. And I can't pretend I know everything about him. I can't pretend I have him figured out. I try, if I'm being honest. I try to scrape together all my data on him. I try my best regression analysis. I try to write a predictive model in my head and use it to set expectations for what he'd say or do about this or about that. I try, but despite my best efforts, God still surprises me. God still does things I don't understand. God still says things that trouble me, that keep me up at night. God still allows things to happen to me or around me that I prefer he didn't. Sometimes God lets me get hurt. Sometimes God lets me lose. And I hate it. God still surprises me. And sometimes, brothers and sisters, that scares me. And I think the elders of Israel were scared too. The elders of Israel didn't seem to know how to make sense of that first defeat. They weren't supposed to lose because God's people don't lose, right? Or do they? Sometimes. Why? When? Under what conditions? Why? For what causes? To teach which lessons? How do we make sure it doesn't happen again? If only God would tell us what to do to make sure he's on our side, to make sure he does what we want him to. If only God would tell us, if only he would maybe write it down, say in a book. And of course, God did have some things written down, but not everything. God didn't explain everything, every part of himself. And God is allowed to do that. God is allowed to leave parts of himself unexplained and mysterious. Why? Because God is a person. And people are mysterious. People are not objects or theorems. People can't be dissected and analyzed and evaluated. The component parts separated, categorized, and strung up like some kind of abstraction mobile. God is a person, and that isn't easy to deal with. So even though it was so achingly foolish, I get why the elders of Israel didn't even stop to ask God what he wanted them to do. Did you notice that? When the soldiers returned to camp, the elders of Israel asked, "Why did the Lord bring defeat on us today before the Philistines? Let us bring the Ark of the Lord's covenant from Shiloh, so that he may go with us and save us from the hand of our enemies." The elders of Israel asked and answered their question without waiting to hear from God. Even though God had appointed Samuel to be his spokesperson for all Israel, to all Israel knew they could just ask Samuel, they didn't bother to consult him. As Samura suggests, the implication of this verse as a whole would be, though the word of Samuel was recognized throughout Israel, the people went out for battle without asking the will of the Lord through his prophet. And again, I get why they might not have wanted to give God a chance to speak his peace. What if God said something they didn't want to hear? What if God told them his plan was for them to suffer for a while? What if God told them it was time to be under the Philistines for a little bit? What if God conditioned victory on something they didn't want to do? What if God had his own thoughts about what should happen and when it should happen and how it should happen? What if God had his own thoughts? This was a risk the elders of Israel were unwilling to take. And they were sure they knew how God worked, how the ark worked, how gods and nations and warfare worked. They didn't need any more data muddying and slowing down their decision making. The Philistines were at the gates. They needed to act now. And to the elders of Israel, God was a trump card, an ace up their sleeve, an object, an it that they could wrap their hands around and take and bring and use against their enemies. Peterson observes, the God who was revealed as personal and sovereign at Midian and Sinai had been traded in for a God in a box, that the leaders thought could work magic against the Philistines at Aphek. To Israel's leaders, God wasn't a you, but an it. And brothers and sisters, the question is, what about us? Who or what is God to us? Is God an it or a you? Is God an object to be studied? A tool to be used? A weapon to be turned against our enemies? Do we speak often of God in the third person, using a he that feels more like an it? Do we speak of God and of what God is for and of what God is against, rather than speaking to God and allowing him to be the actual person he is? It's tempting. It's so tempting to reduce God to an it, as did the elders of Israel. It's tempting to assume we know enough about God to speak for him, to believe we've learned enough about God and how he works and how the church and the world work to know how God would think or feel or speak or act about any given topic or situation. It's tempting to think we have God figured out, all his policy positions plotted out on our ideological maps. Yet whatever we think we know, many of us actually do know the pain of being objectified. We know what it feels like to be reduced to a set of positions and values and qualities by an observer, by an analyst, by a critic, by someone on the other side. Yet it's easy to do this to others, even knowing the pain it inflicts. It's easy to do this even to God. Why? Why is it so easy? Well, I don't know all your reasons. Maybe it's not easy for you, but I know mine because it is easy for me. It's easier to reduce God to an object than to treat him like a person because sometimes I perceive his personhood, his agency, as a threat to my own. Sometimes I don't want to risk God doing, saying, or asking something I don't like, especially when I'm already feeling fearful or angry, especially when I'm already wounded and grieving. After all, how could I resist him? No, a God who can be figured out, ideally who has already been figured out, so I can just read about him in a book, that kind of God is much easier to handle. It's much easier to take that God, to bring that God, to use that God, to wield that kind of God. In other words, I objectify God because I don't always trust him to be good, and I want to be in control. I reduce him to an it because an it is more predictable, more containable, more controllable, posing, therefore, much less of a threat than a you. God as a person with power and authority beyond my own scares me more than God as an object. And perhaps, brothers and sisters, perhaps sometimes God as a person scares you too. It's scary not to be in total control of our lives. It's scary to entrust our well-being to someone else. And it only gets harder the more we feel like we might have lost. It only gets harder the more we feel like we are losing, whether it's our health or our wealth or our influence or our status or our relationships or our opportunities. The more we lose, the less safe we feel with a God we can't control. On the other hand, we can distance ourselves from an objectified God. We can contain it in a set of ideas or a theological framework or even far off in a world of fantasy where it can't reach us, where it can't hurt us. An objectified God can even make us feel powerful. An objectified God is easy to shape to our purposes, to our agendas. We can take God, highlight God's qualities and quotes that seem to support our side, and we can wield God against the other side. And when we have pastors and pundits and podcasters and politicians encouraging us to use God in these ways, though they never put it that way, the empowerment can become intoxicating. When the alternative is coming to God person to person with our whole selves laid bare before his whole self, in complete vulnerability before his mystery, it's only natural to want to objectify God instead. God has the right as a free person not beholden to anyone's agenda but his own. He has the right to treat us in whatever way he determines is right and good and wise. And it's just so hard and it's just so scary to be that vulnerable. But brothers and sisters, vulnerability is safe where trust has been earned. If one person has taken steps to earn that trust, the other person can take their own steps forward. And step after step, the you of one person and the I of the other will find themselves moving towards one another and then with one another until one day they realize they've been dancing together in the intimacy of love. Brothers and sisters, God has taken such steps towards us. God has taken many steps for thousands and even millions, billions of years, culminating in the moment he stepped into this world, putting on himself the vulnerability of humanity, setting aside the omnipotence of divinity so he could know us as people do. And even after the incarnate God returned to heaven, by his Holy Spirit, he still dwells among us. He comes to us even now, even in this space, in this auditorium, in this moment, in the air we are breathing this day. He is here even now under our very skin, in the chambers of our beating hearts. God is present among us, saying to us, "Here I am. I stand at the door and knock. If anyone hears my voice and opens the door, I will come in and eat with that person, and they with me." Brothers and sisters, do you know God in the second person? Is he the you to your I? Do you know that you are the you to his I? He desires it be so. God, you desire us to know you and to be known by you. You want us to see you, to hear you. You want us to speak to you. You want to receive from us our gaze and our words too. You want us to be known by you, not as an object to be studied, not as an it to be handled and used. And it's this desire, this invitation that we want to take today, God. The way of Jesus led him to the table of communion. Though the upper room had only just been rented that day, the table of communion had already existed for thousands of years. God shared a table with Abraham. God shared a table with Moses and the 70 elders of Israel on Mount Sinai. God taught Israel to meet him at the table of the fellowship offering. God spread a table for David in the presence of his enemies. God in Jesus shared a table with his disciples the night before he was crucified. God has been taking steps toward us all this time, table in tow. In taking communion, we affirm our desire to meet him at his table and to know him in the second person. So let's try that now. Let's take some time in silence to speak in our hearts to God that elemental word, "You are here, and so am I." Or perhaps you have something else you need to say to God, not about God, not in reference to God, but to God. Maybe there's something you need to tell him today. Say it now to him. He's waiting. Or perhaps you need to hear something from God. Perhaps he has something to say to you. Wait and listen, but receive now this benediction. As you go from this place into a world that may seem devoid of the presence of God, may the Spirit hunt you down, chase you, and present himself to you. And may you receive his gaze that you may know him as the person he is, not just on the weekends, but every day of your life. May God bless you. Be well.